My girl's to stay in. She wants out, that's her business. I'd have to ask how she's going to earn a living. He let that one trail, his voice tinged with skepticism. Meaning what? I'm not following. I'm just trying to picture her working in a department store, waitressing, something like that. Minimum wage type job. Beat up like that, it'd be tough, of course, but as long as she don't mind coming down in the world, who am I to object? You got scars on your face, might be a trick to get employment.
Nobody said anything about facial scars, I said. Where'd you get that idea?
Oh, well, I just assumed. Word on the street is she got busted up bad. Naturally, I thought, you know, some unfortunate facial involvement. It's a pity, of course, but a lot of guys try to do that, interfere with a poor girl's ability to make a living, undercut their confidence, and shit like that.
Cheney reappeared, his gaze shifting with curiosity from Lester's face to mine.
Everything okay?
Sure, fine, I said tersely.
We're just talking business, Lester said. I never did hear how Danielle is. Is she going to be all right?
Time to go, Cheney said to him. We'll walk you out to your car.
Hey, sure thing. Where they got her, up in orthopedics? I could send some flowers if I knew. Someone told me her jaw's broke. Probably some coked-up lunatic.
Skip the flowers. We're not giving out information. Doctor's orders, Cheney said.
Pretty smart. I was going to suggest that myself. Keeps her safe from the wrong types.
I said, too late for that. But the irony escaped him. Once we reached the street in front of St. Terry's, we did a parting round of handshakes as though we just had a business meeting. The minute Lester's back was turned, I wiped my hand on my jeans. Cheney and I waited on the sidewalk until we saw him drive away. Chapter 17. It was close to 4 in the morning as Cheney's little red Mazda droned through the darkened streets. With the top down, the wind whipped across my face. I leaned my head back and watched the sky race by. On the mountain side of the city, the shadowy foothills were strung with necklaces of streetlights, as twinkling as bulbs on a Christmas tree. In the houses we passed, I could see an occasional house light wink on as early morning workers plugged in the coffee and staggered to the shower.
Too cold for you?
This is fine, I said. Lester seemed to know a lot about Danielle's beating. You think he did it?
Not if he wanted her to work, Cheney said.
The sky at that hour is a plain, unbroken gray, shading down to the black of trees. Dew saturates the grass. Sometimes you can hear the spritzing of the rainbirds, computers programmed to water lawns before the sun has fully risen. If the cycle of low rainfall persisted, as it had in the past, water usage would be restricted, and all the lush grass would die. During the last drought, many homeowners had been reduced to spraying their yards with dense green paint. On Cabana Boulevard, a kid on a skateboard careened along the darkened sidewalk. It occurred to me that I'd been waiting to see the juggler, the man on the bike, with his taillight and pumping feet. He was beginning to represent some capricious force at work, elfin and evil, some figment of my imagination, dancing along ahead of me like the answer to a riddle. Wherever I went, he'd eventually appear, always headed somewhere in a hurry, never quite arriving at his destination. Cheney had slowed, leaning forward to check the skateboarder as we passed him. Cheney raised a hand in greeting, and the kid waved back.
"Who's that?" I asked. "Works night maintenance at a convalescent home. He had his driver's license pulled on a DUI. Actually, he's a good kid," he said.
Moments later, he turned into Danielle's alley, where my car was still parked. He pulled in behind the VW, shifting into neutral to minimize the rumble of his engine.
"How's your day looking? Will you have time to sleep?"
"I hope so. I'm really bushed," I said.
"Are you going to work?" "I'm going home to bed, for a couple of hours at any rate. I'll give you a call later. If you're up for it, we can get a bite to eat someplace."
"Let me see how my day shapes up. If I'm not in, leave a number. I'll get back to you."
"You going into the office?"
"Actually, I thought I'd go over to Danielle's and clean. Last I saw, the place was covered with blood."
"You don't have to do that. The landlord said he'd have a crew come in first thing next week. He can't get 'em till Monday, but it's better than you doing it."
I don't mind. I'd like to do something for her. Maybe pick up her robe and slippers and take them over to St. Terry's.
Up to you, he said. I'll watch till you take off. Make sure your car starts and the boogeyman don't get you.
I opened the car door and got out, reaching down for my handbag. Thanks for the ride and for everything else. I mean that.
You're welcome.
I slammed the door, moving over to my car while Cheney hovered like a guardian angel. The VW started without a murmur. I waved to demonstrate that everything was okay, but he wasn't ready to let go. He followed me home, the two of us winding up and down the darkened streets. For once, I found a parking space right in front of my place. At that point, he seemed to feel I was safe. He shifted into first and took off. I locked the car, went through the gate, and walked around to the back, where I unlocked my front door and let myself in. I scooped up the mail that had been shoved through the slot, flipped a light on, set my bag down, and locked the front door behind me. I started peeling off my clothes as I climbed the spiral stairs, littering the floor with discarded articles of clothing like those scenes in romantic comedies where the lovers can hardly wait. I felt that way about sleep. Naked, I staggered around, closing the blinds, turning off the phone, dousing lights. I crawled under the quilt with a sigh of relief. I thought I was too tired to sleep, but as it turned out, I wasn't. I didn't wake until well after 5 p.m. For a moment, I thought I'd slept all the way around the clock until the next dawn. I stared up at the clear plexiglass dome above my bed, trying to orient myself in the half-light. Given the early February sunsets, the day was already draining away like gray water from the bottom of a bathtub. I assessed my mental state and decided I'd probably had enough sleep, realized I was starving, and hauled myself out of bed. I brushed my teeth, showered, and shampooed my hair. Afterward, I pulled on an old sweatshirt and worn jeans. Downstairs, I collected a plastic bucket full of rags and cleaning products. Now that the immediate crisis had passed, I found myself tuning into the rage I felt for her assailant. Men who beat women were almost as low as men who beat kids. I tried Cheney's number, but he was apparently already up and out. I left a message on his machine, indicating the time of day and the fact that I was too hungry to wait for him. When I opened my front door, a manila envelope dropped out of the frame where it had been tucked. Across the front, Hector had scrawled a note.
Friday, 5:35 p. Knocked, but no answer. Amended transcript and tape enclosed. Sorry I couldn't be more help. Give me a call when you get back.
He jotted down his home number and the number for the studio. He must have stopped by and knocked while I was in the shower. I checked the time. He'd apparently been there only 15 minutes before, and I had to guess it was too soon to catch him at either number. I tucked both the tape and the transcript in my handbag, and then took myself to a coffee shop, where breakfast was served 24 hours a day. I studied Hector's notations while I made a pig of myself, hastily consuming a plate full of the sorts of foodstuffs nutritionists forbid. He hadn't managed to decipher much more than I had. To my page of notes, he'd added the following. Hey, I hate that stuff. Myself, think. You're not... Oh, come on, I'm just kidding. Laughter. But you have to admit it's a great idea. She goes in at the same time every day. Deify. You're sick. People shouldn't get in my... Clatter, clink. Sound of water. Squeak. If anything happens, I'll... Thump, thump. I'm serious. Stubby. No link. Laughter. Chair scrape. Rustle. Murmur. At the bottom of the page, he'd scrawled three big question marks. My sentiments exactly. When I reached Danielle's cottage, I parked in the alleyway near the hedges as I had the night before. It was dark by then. At this rate, I might never see full sun again. I took out my flashlight and checked the batteries, satisfied that the beam was still strong. I spent a few minutes walking along the borders of the alleyway, using the blade of light to cut through the weeds on either side. I didn't expect to find anything. I wasn't really looking for evidence as such. I wanted to see if I could figure out where Danielle's assailant might have gone. There were any number of places where he might have hidden, yards he could have crossed to reach the streets on either side. In the middle of the night, even a slender tree trunk can provide cover. For all I knew, he'd taken up a position within easy viewing distance, watching the ambulance and all the cop cars arrive. I went back to Danielle's cottage, where I crossed the backyard to the main house. I climbed the back steps and knocked on the lighted kitchen window. I could see Danielle's landlord rinsing dinner dishes before he placed them in the rack. He caught sight of me at just about that time and came to the back door, drying his hands on a dish towel. I got a key from him, pausing to chat for a few minutes about the assault. He'd gone to bed at 10. He said he was a light sleeper, but his bedroom was on the second floor, the street side of the house, and he'd heard nothing. He was a man in his 70s, retired military, though he didn't say which branch. If he knew how Danielle made a living, he made no comment. He seemed as fond of her as I was, and that was all I cared about. I professed ignorance of her current status, except to indicate that she'd survived and was expected to recover. He didn't press for specifics. I walked back along the brick path to Danielle's small porch. The crime scene tape had been removed, but I could still see traces of fingerprint powder around the doorknob and frame. The rag-wrapped length of bloody pipe would probably be tested for fingerprints, but I doubted it would yield much. I let myself into the cottage and flipped on the overhead light. The splattered blood was like a Rorschach, a dark red pattern of smears and exclamation marks where the force of the blows had flung blood in two tracks across the wall. The blood-stained rug had been removed, probably tossed in the trash can at the rear of the lot. The blood on the baseboard looked like teardrops of paint. The entire apartment was barely a room and a half, and cheaply constructed. I toured the premises, though there wasn't much to see. Like mine, Danielle's living quarters occupied a very small space. It looked as though Danielle's battle with her assailant had been confined to the front room, most of which was taken up with a sitting area and a king-size bed. The sheets and comforter were a Laura Ashley print, pink and white floral polished cotton with matching drapes, and a correlating pink and white striped paper lined the walls. Her kitchen consisted of a hot plate and a microwave oven sitting atop a painted chest of drawers. The bathroom was small, painted white, with tiny old-fashioned black and white tiles on the floor. The sink was skirted in the same Laura Ashley print she'd used in the bedroom. She'd bought a matching polished cotton shower curtain with a valance covering the rod. The wall opposite the John was a mini-gallery. A dozen framed photographs were hung close together, many sitting crooked on the hangers. Danielle must have been flung up against the connecting wall during the assault. Several had been knocked off the wall and lay face down on the tile floor. I lifted them with care. Two of the frames had smashed on impact, and the glass in all four was either badly cracked or broken. I stacked the four damaged pictures together, tossing glass shards in the trash, and then straightening the remaining photographs, pausing to absorb the subject matter. Danielle as a baby. Danielle with Mom and Dad. Danielle at about 9, in a dance recital, with her hair done up. I went back into the front room and found a thick sheaf of brown grocery bags tucked in the slot between the wall and the chest of drawers. I put the damaged framed photographs in the bag and set them by the front door. I'd seen similar frames at the drugstore for a couple of bucks apiece. Maybe I'd stop by and pick up some replacements. I pulled all the linens off the bed and set them out on the porch. Even the dust ruffle had picked up a spray of blood posies. I'd make a trip to the cleaners in the morning. I filled my bucket with hot water, mixing a potent brew of cleaning solutions. I wiped down the walls, scrubbed the baseboards and floors until the soapy water turned a frothy pink. I dumped that lot, refilled the bucket, and started over again. When I'd finished, I pulled out the transcript and sat down on the bed, using Danielle's phone to try Hector at his home number. He answered promptly. "This is Kinsey here. I'm glad I caught you at home. I thought you might be on your way to the studio."
"Not this early, and today not at all. I work Saturday through Wednesday, so Thursday and Friday nights are usually my weekend. Last night was an exception, but I try to keep those to a minimum. I got hot plans tonight. I give Beauty a bath, and then she gives me one." "You got the transcript, I take it."
"Yeah, and I'm sorry I missed you. I was in the shower when you dropped it off." We spent a few minutes commiserating with one another about the poor quality of the tape recording. "What did you make of it?
Not much. I picked up a couple of words, but nothing that made any sense.
You have any idea what they're talking about?
Nope. Lorna sounds upset with him, is mostly what I pick up.
You're sure it's Lorna?
I couldn't swear, but I'm pretty sure it was her.
What about the guy?
I didn't recognize his voice. Doesn't sound like anyone I'm familiar with. You ought to listen again yourself and see what you hear. Maybe we can take turns filling in the missing pieces, like a jigsaw puzzle.
We don't have to make it our life's work, I said. I'm not even sure it's relevant, but I'll have another go at it when I get home. I glanced down at the annotated transcript. What about this word deify? That seems odd, doesn't it? Deify who?
I wasn't really sure about that one, but it's the only word I could think of. Phrase I keep running through my head is that business about she goes in at the same time every day. I don't know what the hell that's about.
And why stubby? Lorna says that, I think.
Well, this may sound odd, but I'll tell you the hit I got on that. I don't think she's using stubby as an adjective. There's a guy here in town with the nickname Stubby. She could be talking about him.
That's an interesting possibility. This was someone she knew?
Presumably. His real name is John Stockton. Call him Stubby because he's a little short, fat guy. He's a developer.
Wait a minute, I cut in. I just heard that name. I'm almost sure Clark Esselman referred to him. Assuming there's only one, is he a member of the Colgate Water Board?
Hector laughed. Whoa, no chance. They'd never let him on the board. Talk about a conflict of interests. He'd vote himself into half a dozen get-rich schemes.
Oh, then it's probably not related. Was she talking to or about him?
About him, I'd guess. Actually, there could be some marginal connection. Stockton would have to apply to the water board if he were trying to get a permit for some kind of development. Since Lorna babysat with Esselman, she might have heard about Stubby in passing.
Yeah, but so what? In a town like this, you hear about a lot of things, but that doesn't get you killed. How hard is it to get a permit?
It's not hard to apply, but with the current water shortage, it'd take a hell of a project to get them to say yes.
I said, well... I ran the idea around a couple of laps, but it didn't seem to produce any insights. I don't know how that pertains. If they're talking about water, it might tie in somehow with she goes in at the same time every day. Maybe that references to swimming. I know Lorna jogged, but did she also swim?
Not that I ever heard. Besides, if the guy's talking to Lorna, why refer to her as she? He's got to be talking about someone else. And Stockton doesn't have anything to do with swimming pools. He does malls and subdivisions, he said. With a phrase like that, they could be talking about work. She goes in to work at the same time every day, or she goes in to bed at the same time every day.
True. Oh, well. Maybe something will occur to us if we give it a rest. Anything else strike you? I asked.
Not really. Just that Lorna sounded pissed.
I thought so, too, which is why I listened so carefully. Whatever the guy's saying, she didn't like it a bit.
Ah, well... Like you say, if it's ever going to make any sense, you'll probably have to leave it alone for a while. If I have a brainstorm, I'll give you a buzz.
Thanks, Hector. By the time I locked up and returned the key to Danielle's landlord, it was close to 6:45, and the place was looking better. The smell of ammonia suggested an institutional setting, but at least Danielle wouldn't have to come home to a shambles. I went out to my car, arms loaded with odds and ends. I set the plastic bucket on the front seat on the passenger side and stuck the bundle of bedclothes on the back seat, along with the paper bag holding the broken picture frames. I slid in behind the steering wheel and sat for a moment, trying to think what to do next. Hector's suggestion about Stubby Stockton as the subject of Lorna's taped conversation was mildly intriguing. From what I'd overheard of Clark Esselman's comments on the phone, Stockton would be present at the upcoming board meeting, which was tonight by my calculations. With luck, maybe I'd run into Serena, and I could quiz her again on the subject of the missing money. I found a public phone at the nearest gas station and looked up the number for the Colgate Water District. It was way past working hours, but the message on the answering machine gave details about the meeting, which was scheduled at 7 in the conference room at the district offices. I hopped in the car, fired up the engine again, and hit the highway heading north. 14 minutes later, I pulled into the parking lot behind the building. Uncomfortably aware of a steady stream of cars both ahead of me and behind. Like some kind of car rally, we nosed into parking lots one after the other. I shut my engine down and got out, locking the car behind me. It was easy enough to determine where the meeting was being held, simply by following the other attendees. At the back end of the building, I could see lights on, and I trotted in that direction, starting to feel competitive about the available seating spaces. The entrance to the conference room was tucked into a small enclosed patio. Through the plate glass window, I could see the water board members already in place. I went in, anxious to get settled while there were still seats left. The meeting room was drab and functional. Brown carpet, walls paneled in dark wood veneer, an L of folding tables up front, and 35 folding chairs for the audience. There was a big coffee urn on a table to one side, a stack of cups, sugar packets, and a big jar of Cremora. The lighting was fluorescent and made all of us look yellow. The Colgate Water Board consisted of 7 members, each with an engraved plate indicating name and title. Counsel for the Water District, the General Manager and Chief Engineer, the President, and 4 directors, one of whom was Clark Esselman. The board member named Ned, whom he'd talked to by phone, was apparently Theodore Ramsey, now seated 2 chairs away. The Bob and Drusilla he'd mentioned in passing were Robert Ennisbrook and Drusilla Chatham, respectively. Appropriately enough, the water board members had been provided big pitchers of iced water, and they poured and drank water lustily while discussing its scarcity. Some of the members I knew by name or reputation, but with the exception of Esselman, I didn't recognize any of their faces. Serena was in the front row, fussing with her belongings and trying to act as if she weren't worried about her father. Esselman, in a suit and tie, looked frail but determined. He was already engaged in conversation with Mrs. Chatham, the woman to his left. Many people had already assembled, and most of the available folding chairs were filled. I spotted an empty chair and claimed it, wondering what I was doing here. Some attendees had briefcases or legal pads. The man next to me had written out a commentary in longhand, which he seemed to be refining while we waited for the meeting to begin. I turned and checked the rows behind me, all of which were occupied. Through the plate glass window, I could see additional people seated at the picnic table or lounging against the ornamental fence. Speakers on the patio allowed the overflow crowd to hear the proceedings. Copies of the agenda were stacked up front, and I left my seat briefly so that I could snag one for myself. I gathered that members of the audience would be free to address the board. To that end, requests were filled out and submitted. There were many consultations back and forth, people who seemed to know one another, some in small groups representing a particular petition. I wasn't even sure what the issues were, and the agenda I scanned made it all sound so tedious I wasn't sure I cared. I wondered if I'd be able to identify Stubby Stockton on sight. A lot of us looked short and fat while seated. At 7:03, the meeting was called to order with a roll call of board members present. Minutes of the previous meeting were read and approved without modification. Various items on the consent agenda were approved without discussion. Much rustling and coughing and throat clearing throughout. Everyone seemed to speak in a monotone, so that every subject was reduced to its most boring components. Service policies were discussed among the board members in the sort of dry style reserved for congressional filibusters. If anything was actually being accomplished, it was lost on me. What struck me as curious was that Clark Esselman, in his telephone conversation with Ned at the house, had seemed quite passionate. Behind the scenes, feelings apparently ran high. Here, every effort was made to neutralize emotion in the interest of public service. One by one, members of the audience were able to approach the podium, addressing the board members with prepared statements. These they read aloud in their best sing-song public speaking voices, managing somehow to deliver their comments without any spontaneity, humor, or warmth. As in church, the combination of body heat and hot air was bringing the surrounding air temperature up to anesthetic levels. For someone as sleep-deprived as I'd been for the last 5 days, it was hard to keep from toppling off my chair sideways. I'm ashamed to confess I actually nodded off once, a sort of dip in consciousness that I became aware of only because my head dropped. It must have happened again, because just as I began to enjoy a much-needed snooze, I was jerked upright by a heated verbal exchange. Belatedly, I realized I'd missed the opening round. Clark Esselman was on his feet, stabbing a finger at the man at the podium.
"It's people like you who are ruining this country."
The man he was addressing had to be John Stubby Stockton. He was maybe 5 feet tall and very heavy-set, with a round baby face and dark thinning hair. He was a man who perspired heavily, and throughout the interchange he mopped at his face with his handkerchief.
"People like me! Oh, really, sir, let's leave personalities out of this. This is not about me. This is not about you. This is about jobs for this community. This is about growth and progress for the citizens of this county. The
hogwash. This is about you making money, you damn son of a bitch. What do you care about the citizens of this county? By the time this abomination comes to pass, you'll be well out of it, counting your profits while the rest of us are stuck with this eyesore for centuries to come."
Like lovers, Clark Esselman and John Stockton, having once engaged, seemed to have eyes only for each other. The room was electrified, a ripple of excitement undulating through the audience. Stockton's voice was syrupy with loathing.
"Sir, at the risk of offending, let me ask you this. What have you done to generate employment or housing or financial security for the citizens of Santa Teresa County? Would you care to answer that?"
"Don't change the subject."
"Because the answer is nothing. You haven't contributed a stick, not a nickel or a brick, to the fiscal health and well-being of the community you live in."
"That is untrue. That is untrue,"
Esselman shouted. Stockton forged on.
"You've blocked economic growth, you've obstructed employment opportunities, you've denounced development, impeded all progress. And why not? You've got yours. What do you care what happens to the rest of us? We can all go jump in the ocean as far as you're concerned."
"You're damn right you can jump in the ocean. Go jump in the ocean."
"Gentlemen," the president had risen. "Well, let me tell you something. You'll be long gone, and the opportunity for growth will be long gone, and who's going to pay the price for your failure of imagination?"
"Gentlemen, gentlemen."
The president was banging his gavel on the table without any particular effectiveness. Serena was on her feet, but her father was waving her aside with the kind of peremptory motion that had probably intimidated her from childhood. I saw her sink back down while he shouted, trembling,
"Save your speeches for the Rotary, young man. I'm sick of listening to this self-serving poppycock. The truth is, you're in this for the almighty buck, and you know it. If you're so interested in growth and economic opportunity, then donate the land and all the profits you stand to make. Don't hide behind rhetoric."
"You donate? Why don't you give something? You've got more than the rest of us put together, and don't talk to me about hiding behind rhetoric, you pompous ass."
A uniformed security guard materialized at Stockton's side and took him by the elbow. Stockton shook him off, enraged, but a business associate appeared on the other side of him, and between the two of them he was eased out of the room. Esselman remained on his feet, his eyes glittering with anger. In the general swell of side conversations that followed, I leaned over to the man next to me. "I hate to seem ignorant, but what was that about?"
"John Stockton's trying to get water permits for a big parcel of land he wants to turn around and sell to Marcus Petroleum."
"I thought stuff like that had to go through the County Board of Supervisors," I said.
"It does. It was approved last month by a 5-0 vote on the condition that they use reclaimed water from the Colgate Water District. It looked like it was going to pass without opposition, but now Esselman is mounting a counterattack."
"But why all the heat?"
"Stockton's got some land the oil companies would love to have, all worthless without water. Esselman supported him at first, but now he's suddenly opposed. Stubby feels betrayed."
I thought back to the phone call I'd overheard. Esselman had mentioned the boards being sweet-talked into some kind of deal while he was in the hospital. Was Stockton working on this while Esselman was out ill?
You bet. Damn near succeeded, too. Now that he's back, he's using every ounce of influence to get the application turned down.
The woman in front of us turned and gave us a look of reproach.
There's still business going on here, if you don't mind.
Sorry.
The president of the board was trying desperately to establish order, though the audience didn't seem particularly interested. I put my hand across my mouth.
"Have they voted on this?"
I said in a lower tone. The guy shook his head. "This issue came up a year ago, and the water board set up a blue ribbon panel to investigate and make recommendations. They had environmental impact studies done. You know how it is. Mostly a stalling technique in hopes the whole thing would go away. The matter won't actually come to a vote until next month. That's why they're still hearing testimony on the subject."
The woman in front of us raised a finger to her lips, and our conversation dwindled.
In the meantime, Esselman sat down abruptly, his color high. Serena went around the end of the table and joined him on his side. Much to his displeasure, Stubby Stockton was nowhere to be seen, but I could hear him on the patio, his voice still raised in anger. Someone was trying to calm him, but without much success. The meeting picked up again, the president moving adroitly to the next item on the agenda, a fire sprinkler system agreement that didn't upset anyone. By the time I slipped out, Stockton was gone, and the patio was empty. Chapter 18. I drove over to St. Terry's, stopping to fill my car with gas on the way. I knew I'd reached the hospital after visiting hours had ended, but ICU had its own set of rules and regulations. Family members were allowed 1 5-minute visit out of every hour. The hospital was as brightly lit as a resort hotel, and I was forced to circle the block looking for a parking space. I moved through the lobby and took a right turn, heading for the elevators to the intensive care unit upstairs. Once I reached the floor, I used the wall-mounted phone to call into the ward. The night shift nurse who answered was polite but didn't recognize my name. She put me on hold without actually verifying Danielle's presence on the ward. I studied the pastel seascape hanging on the wall. Moments later, she was back on the phone with me, this time using a friendlier tone. Cheney had apparently left word that I was to be admitted. She probably thought I was a cop. I stood in the hallway and watched Danielle through the window to her room. Her hospital bed had been elevated to a slight incline. She seemed to doze. Her long, dark hair fanned out across the pillow and trailed over the side of the bed. The bruising on her face seemed more pronounced tonight, the white tape across her nose a stark contrast to the swollen, sooty-looking black and blue eye sockets. Her mouth was dark and puffy. Her jaw had probably been wired shut because there was none of the slack-jawed look of someone sleeping. Her IV was still in place, as was her catheter.
"You need to talk to her?"
I turned to find the nurse from the night before. "I don't want to bother her," I said.
"I have to wake her up anyway to take her vital signs. You might as well come in. Just don't upset her."
"I won't. How's she doing?"
"She's doing pretty well. She's on a lot of pain medication, but she's been awake off and on. In another day or two, we could probably move her down to medical, but we think she's safer up here."
I stood quietly beside the bed while the nurse took Danielle's blood pressure and her pulse, adjusting the drip on her IV. Danielle's eyes came open in that groggy, confused fashion of someone who can't quite remember where she is or why. The nurse made a note in the chart and left the room. Danielle's green eyes shone stark in the cloudy mass of bruises around her eyes. I said,
"Hi, how are you?"
"I've been better," she said through her teeth. "Got my jaw wired shut. That's why I'm talking like this."
"I figured as much. Are you in pain?"
"Nah, I'm high,"
she smiled briefly, not moving her head.
"I never saw the guy, in case you're wondering. All I remember is opening the door."
"Not surprising," I said. "It may come back in time."
"Hope not."
"Yeah. Tell me if you get tired. I don't want to wear you down."
"I'm okay. I like the company. What have you been up to?"
"Not much. I'm on my way home from a meeting at the water board. What a zoo. The old guy Lorna used to sit for got into a big shouting match with a developer named Stubby Stockton. The rest of the meeting was such a bore until then it nearly put me to sleep."
Danielle made a murmuring sound to show she was listening. Her lid seemed heavy, and I thought she was close to nodding off herself. I'd hoped Stubby's name would spark some recognition, but maybe Danielle didn't have a lot of spark to spare. "Did Lorna ever mention Stubby Stockton to you?" I wasn't sure she even heard me. There was quiet in the room, and then she seemed to rouse herself.
"Client," she said.
"He was a client?" I said, startled. I thought about that for a moment, trying to process the information. "That surprises me somehow. He didn't seem like her type. When was this?"
"Long time. I think she only saw him once. Other guy's the one."
"What other guy?"
"Old guy."
"The one what?"
"Lorna screwed."
"Oh, I don't think so. You must have him mixed up with somebody else. Clark Esselman is Serena Bonnie's father. He's the old guy she babysat." She moved her good hand, plucking at the bedclothes. "You need something?"
"Water."
I looked over at the rolling bed table. On it was a styrofoam pitcher full of water, a plastic cup, and a plastic straw with an accordion section that created a joint about halfway down. "You're okay to drink this? I don't want you cheating because I don't know any better." She smiled.
"Wouldn't cheat here."
I filled the plastic cup and bent the straw, then held the cup near her head, turning the straw at an angle until it touched her lips. She took three small sips, sucking lightly.
"Thanks."
"You were talking about someone Lorna was involved with."
"Esselman."
"You sure we're talking about the same guy?"
"Boss's father-in-law, right?"
"Well, yeah, but why didn't you tell me before? This could be important."
"Thought I did. What difference does it make?"
"Fill me in and we'll see what difference."
"He was into kinky."
She winced, trying to rearrange herself slightly in the bed. A spasm of pain seemed to cross her face. "You okay? You don't have to talk about this right now."
"I'm fine. Ribs feel like shit is all. Rest a minute."
I waited, thinking, kinky? I pictured Esselman getting his fanny spanked while he cavorted around in a garter belt. I could see Danielle struggle to pull herself together.
"She went there after his heart attack, but he came on to her. She said she about fell over. Not that she gave a shit. Buck's a buck, and he paid her a fortune. But she didn't expect it when he seemed so proper."
"I'll bet. And his daughter never knew?"
"No one did. Then later, Lorna let the information slip. She said word got back, and that's the last she saw of him. She felt bad. Daughter wanted to hire her, but old guy wouldn't have it."
"What do you mean, word got back? Who'd she let the information slip to?"
"Don't know. After that, she was tight-lipped. Said you only have to learn that lesson once."
Behind me, someone said, "Excuse me." Danielle's ICU nurse was back. "I don't mean to seem rude about this, but could you wrap it up? The doctors really don't want her having more than 5-minute visits." "I understand. That's fine." I looked back at Danielle. "We can talk about this later. You get some rest."
"Right."
Danielle's eyes closed again. I stayed with her for another minute, more for my sake than hers, and then I eased out of the room. The aide at the nurse's station watched my departure. I found myself uncomfortably trying to conjure up an image of Lorna Kepler with Clark Esselman. And kinky. What a thought. It wasn't his age so much as his aura of formality. I couldn't find a way to reconcile his respectability with his alleged sexual proclivities. He'd probably been married to Serena's mother for 50 years or more. This all must have happened before Mrs. Esselman died. I made a 6-block detour to Short's Drugs, where I purchased 4 8x10 picture frames to replace the broken frames I'd brought with me from Danielle's. Lorna and Clark Esselman, what an odd combination. The drugstore seemed filled with the same conflicting images. Arthritis remedies and condoms, bedpans and birth control. While I was at it, I picked up a couple of packs of index cards, and then I went back to my place, trying to think about something else. I parked, flipped the driver's seat forward, and hauled the banker's box full of Lorna's papers from under Danielle's blood-spattered bedclothes. For someone obsessive about the tidiness in my apartment, I seemed to have no compunction at all about the state of my car. I piled my purchases on the box and anchored the load with my chin while I let myself in. I settled in at my desk. I hadn't transcribed and consolidated my notes since the second day I was on the job, and the index cards I'd filled then seemed both scanty and inept. Information accumulates and compounds, layer upon layer, each affecting perception. Using my notebook, my calendar, gas slips, receipts, and plane ticket, I began to reconstruct the events between Tuesday and today, detailing my interviews with Lorna's boss, Roger Bonney, Joseph Ayers and Russell Turpin up in San Francisco, Trini, Serena, Clark Esselman, and the alleged attorney in the limo. Now I had to add Danielle's contention about Lorna's involvement with Clark Esselman. That one I'd have to check out if I could figure out how. I could hardly ask Serena. Actually, it cheered me to see how much ground I'd covered. In 5 days, I'd constructed a fairly comprehensive picture of Lorna's lifestyle. I found myself getting absorbed in my recollections. As fast as I filled cards, I tacked them on the board, a hodgepodge of miscellaneous facts and impressions. It was when I went back through Lorna's finances, transferring data from the schedule of assets, that I caught something I'd missed. Tucked into the file with her stock certificates was the itemized list of the jewelry she'd insured. There were four pieces listed: a necklace of matched garnets, a matching garnet bracelet, a pair of earrings, and a diamond watch. The appraised value totaling $28,000. The earrings were described as graduated stones, 1/2 to 1 carat diamonds, set in double hoops. I'd seen them before. Only Berlin had been wearing them, and I'd assumed they were rhinestones. I checked the time. It was nearly 11, and I was startled to discover I'd been working for almost 2 hours. I picked up the phone and called the Kepler's house, hoping it wasn't too late. Mace answered. What a dick. I hated talking to him. I could hear some kind of televised sporting event blasting away in the background. Probably a prize fight from the sound of the crowd. I stuck a finger up one nostril to disguise my voice. Hi, Mr. Kepler. Is Berlin there, please?
Who's this?
Marcy, I'm a friend. I was over there last week.
Yeah, well, she's out. Her and Trini both.
You know where she's at? We were supposed to meet up, but I forgot where she said.
What did you say your name was?
Marcy. Is she over at the palace?
There was an ominous silence from him, while in the background someone was really getting pounded.
I'll tell you this, Marcy. She better not be over there. She's over at the palace. She's in big trouble with her dad. Is that where she said to meet?
No.
But I was willing to bet money that's where she was. I hung up. I pushed the paperwork aside, shrugged into my jacket, and found my bag, pausing only long enough to run a comb through my hair. When I opened my front door, a man was standing just outside. I leapt back, shrieking, before I saw who it was.
Shit, J.D., what are you doing here? You scared the hell out of me.
He jumped, too, about the same time I had, and he now sagged against the doorframe.
Well, damn, you scared me. I was all set to knock when you came flying out.
He had a hand to his chest.
Hang on, my heart's pounding. Sorry if I scared you. I know I should have called. I just took a chance you'd be here.
How'd you find out where I live?
You gave Lita this card and wrote it right here on the back. You mind if I come in?
All right, if you can keep it brief, I said. I was on my way out. I've got something to take care of. I moved back from the door and watched him edge his way in. I don't like the idea of just anyone waltzing through my place. If I hadn't had some questions for him, I might have left him on the doorstep. His outfit looked like the one I'd seen him in before, but then again, so did mine. Both of us wore faded jeans and blue denim jackets. He still sported cowboy boots to my running shoes. I closed the door behind him and moved to the kitchen counter, hoping to keep him away from my desk. Like most people who see my apartment for the first time, he looked around with interest.
Pretty slick, he said.
I indicated a stool, sneaking a look at my watch. Have a seat.
This is okay. I can't stay long anyway.
I'd offer you something, but about all I've got is uncooked pasta. You like rotelli by any chance?
Don't worry about it. I'm fine, he said.
I perched on one stool and left the other for him, in case he changed his mind. He seemed ill at ease, standing there with both hands stuck in the back pockets of his jeans. His gaze would hit mine and then flicker off. The light in my living room wasn't as kind to his face as the light in his own kitchen, or maybe the unfamiliar surroundings had created new lines of tension. I got tired of waiting to hear what he had to say. Can I help you with something?
Yeah, well, Lita said you stopped by. I got home around 7, and she's pretty upset.
Really, I said, giving it no inflection. I wonder why.
It's this business about the tape. She'd like to have it back if you don't mind.
I don't mind a bit. I moved over to the desk and removed it from the manila envelope Hector had tucked it in. I passed it over to J.D., and he put it in his jacket pocket without really looking at it.
You have a chance to listen? He asked.
He was being way too casual. Briefly. What about you?
Well, I know pretty much what's in it. I mean, I knew what she was doing.
I said, ah, with a noncommittal nod.
Inside, a little voice was going, "Wow, what's this about? This is interesting." Why was she upset?
I guess because she doesn't want the police to find out.
I told her I wouldn't take it to them.
She's not very trusting. You know, she's kind of insecure.
That much I get, J.D., I said. I'm just wondering what's got her so uneasy she'd send you all the way over here.
She's not uneasy. She doesn't want you thinking it was me.
He shifted his weight from one foot to the other, smiling with embarrassment, using his very best, "Aw, shucks" routine.
Didn't want you putting the hairy eyeball on me, scrutinizing.
If there'd been a little dirt on the floor, he'd have stubbed the toe of his boot in it. I scrutinize everyone. It's nothing personal, I said. In fact, since you're here, I have a question for you.
Hey, you go right ahead. I got nothing to hide.
Someone mentioned you went into Lorna's cabin before the cops showed up. He frowned.
Somebody said that? Wonder who?
I don't think it's any secret. Serena Bonney, I said. He nodded.
Well, that's right. See, I knew Lita'd put the mic in there. I knew about the tape, and I didn't want the cops to spot it. So what I did, I opened the door, leaned down, and clipped the mic off the wire. I wasn't even in there a minute, which is why I never thought to mention it.
Did Lorna know she was being taped?
I never said anything. Tell you the truth, I was embarrassed by Lita's behavior. You know, by her attitude. She treated Lorna kind of snippy. She's young and immature, and Lorna's already giving me a hard time about her. If I told her Lita was spying on us, she'd have either laughed her butt off or gotten pissed, and I didn't think it would help their relationship.
They had a bad relationship?
Well, no, it wasn't bad, but it wasn't that good.
Lita was jealous, I suggested.
She might have been a little jealous, I guess.
So what are you here to tell me? That really everything's all right between you and Lita, and neither one of you had any reason to want Lorna out of the way, right?
That's the truth. I know you think somehow I had something to do with Lorna's death.
How could I think that? You told me you were out of town.
That's right, and she was, too. I was set to go fishing with my brother-in-law, and at the last minute she decided to go up to Santa Maria with me while I picked him up. Said she'd rather hang out with her sister than stay here by herself.
Why are you repeating all this stuff? I don't get it.
Because you act like you don't believe us.
Gosh, J.D., how could I fail to believe you when you provide such nice alibis for each other?
It's not an alibi. Now, goddammit, how can it be an alibi when all I'm doing is telling you where we were?
Whose vehicle did you take to go to Lake Nacimiento? He hesitated.
My brother-in-law has a truck. We took that.
Santa Maria's an hour away. How do you know Lita didn't drive back in your car?
I don't for sure, but you could ask her sister. She'd tell you.
Right.
No, she would.
Oh, come on. If you'd lie for Lita, why wouldn't her sister lie, too?
Somebody else must have seen her on Saturday. I think she said they had a makeup party that morning, you know, where some cosmetic sales lady comes and does facials on everyone so they'll buy Mary Jane products or whatever it is. You don't have to get mad.
Mary Kay. But you're right. I shouldn't get mad. I told Lita I'd verify all of this. I haven't had a chance to do it, so it's my fault, not yours.
Now, see, I don't know how you do that. Even when you apologize, you make it sound like you don't mean it. Why are you being so cranky with me?
J.D., I'm cranky because I'm in a hurry and I don't understand what you're up to.
I'm not up to anything. I just came to get the tape. I thought while I was here I'd, you know, discuss it. Anyway, you're the one that asked me. I didn't volunteer. Now it seems like I made it worse.
Okay, I accept that. Let's let it go at that. Otherwise, we'll be standing around all night explaining ourselves to one another.
Okay. As long as you're not mad.
Not a bit.
And you believe me.
I never said that. I said I accept it.
Oh, well, okay then. I guess that's okay.
I could feel my eyes begin to cross. It was 11:20 when I pushed my way through the crowd at Neptune's Palace. The illusion of the ocean depths was profound that night. Watery blue lights shaded down to black. A pattern of light played across the dance floor like the shimmer at the bottom of a pool. I raised my gaze to the ceiling, where a storm at sea was being projected. Lightning forked in a faux sky, and an unseen wind whipped across the ocean surface. I could hear the cracking of the ship's timbers as the rain lashed the mast, the screams of drowning men set against a rock and roll backdrop. Dancers swayed back and forth, their arms undulating in the smoke-heavy air. The music was so loud it was almost no sound, like silence, in the same way that black is every color intensified into nothing. I found a perch at the bar and bought myself a beer while I scanned the crowd. The boys wore mascara and black lipstick, while the girls sported punk haircuts and elaborate tattoos. I kept my gaze carefully averted. The music stopped abruptly, and the dance floor began to clear. I caught a glimpse of a familiar blonde head I could have sworn was Berlin's. She disappeared from view. I eased off the bar stool and circled to the right, peering over the roiling mob to the point where I thought I'd seen her. She was nowhere in sight, but I didn't think I was mistaken. I lingered near a massive saltwater tank where a flat eel with vicious teeth was devouring a hapless fish. Suddenly I spotted her, sitting at a table with a beefy guy in a tank top, fatigue pants, and heavy army boots. His head had been shaved bald, but his shoulders and forearms were still thick with fur. Any body part not covered with hair seemed to be adorned with some kind of tattoo, dragons and snakes. I could see the ridges in his skull and rolls of flesh along his neck. I've often thought of fat backs as the portion of the human body that aliens would most prefer to eat. Berlin sat in profile. She'd shrugged off her leather jacket, which was now hanging over the back of her chair, anchored by her shoulder bag. She was wearing the earrings, two diamond-encrusted hoops dangling down on either side. Her skirt was green satin, and like her black one, short and tight. While she talked, she made frequent reference to the earrings, touching first one and then the other, reassuring herself that both were still in place. She seemed self-conscious, perhaps unaccustomed to wearing such ornate jewelry. The light from the candle in the middle of her table caught the myriad facets of the stones. Booming music broke the air, and the two got up to dance again. Berlin wore the same high, spiky heels, perhaps in hopes of lending grace to ankles that were otherwise as shapeless as porch posts. She had a butt on her like a loaded backpack tied around her waist. The table next to theirs had emptied, and I slid onto the chair next to hers. Trini suddenly appeared to my right. I'd have avoided the contact, but I knew she'd already spotted me. "Hi, Trini. How are you? I didn't know you came here."
"Everybody comes here. This is hot."
She was glancing around as she spoke, snapping her fingers while she did some kind of chin thrust in time to the music. I wondered if this was mating behavior.
"You here by yourself?"
"Nuh-uh. I came with Burl. She has a boyfriend she meets here because Daddy doesn't like him."
"Really? Berlin's here, too? Where'd she go?"
"Right out on the dance floor. She was sitting right here."
She pointed in the general direction of the dance floor, and I peered dutifully. Berlin was doing a bump-and-grind number with the beefy boyfriend. I could see his shaved head towering above the other heads bobbing on the dance floor.
"That's the guy your dad doesn't like. I can't imagine."
Trini shrugged.
"It's his hair, I think. Daddy's kind of conservative. He doesn't think guys should shave their heads."
"Yeah, but what difference could it make when he's got so much hair everywhere else?" I said.
Trini made a face. "I don't like guys with hairy backs."
"Nice earrings Berlin's wearing. Where'd she get them? I wouldn't mind a pair of those myself."
"They're just rhinestones."
"Rhinestones? That's cool. They look like real diamonds from here, don't you think?"
"Oh, right, like she's really going to wear diamonds."
"Maybe she got them at one of those stores that sells look-alike jewels. You know, emeralds and rubies and like that. I look at that stuff and I can't tell the difference."
"Yeah, maybe."
I looked up. A fellow doing chin thrusts and a lot of finger-popping was standing near Trini's chair. She got up and started bumping and grinding on the spot. I waved at the air, trying to watch the dance floor around their flailing arms.
"Do you mind?"
Two of them began to bebop in the direction of the dance floor. I found Berlin again with her bow. I kept my eyes pinned on their heads bobbing on the dance floor. I leaned over as if to tie my shoe and slid my hand down into her purse. I felt her wallet, cosmetic bag, hairbrush. I sat up again and then simply extracted the handbag from the back of the chair where she'd hung it,
leaving mine in its place. I hefted the strap across one shoulder and moved off to the ladies' room. There were 5 or 6 women at the basins, makeup paraphernalia scattered across the shelving provided. All were engaged in a frenzy of hair ratting, blusher brushes, and lip pencils, not even looking up as I went into a stall and slid the bolt across. I hung the bag over a hook that had been thoughtfully provided by the management and began to search in earnest. Berlin's wallet was not that educational. Driver's license, a couple of credit cards, a few folded credit card receipts shoved down among the currency. Her checkbook showed a series of deposits at weekly intervals, which I assumed represented paychecks from Kepler Plumbing Incorporated. Chick was seriously underpaid. Scanning back over the last several months, I spotted an occasional deposit of $2,500, usually followed by checks made out to holiday travel. That was interesting. I found the small velvet jeweler's box in which the earrings were probably kept. I tried the interior zippered compartment, sorting through old grocery lists, thrifty drugstore receipts, deposit slips. I pulled out passbooks for 2 different savings accounts. The first had been opened with a $9,000 deposit about a month after Lorna's death. I could see intermittent withdrawals of $2,500, bringing the current balance down to $1,500. The second account held another $6,000. There was probably a third account somewhere else. Berlin had tucked the carbons of her deposit and withdrawal slips in the back of one passbook, information she didn't dare leave at home. If Janice had discovered her cache of hidden funds, sticky questions would arise. I lifted a carbon slip from each passbook. Someone knocked on the stall. "Are you dead in there?" "Just a minute," I called. I depressed the toilet handle, letting the toilet flush noisily while I shoved everything back in the handbag. I emerged from the stall with a bag over my shoulder. A black girl with a 70s afro moved into the stall I'd vacated. I found an empty basin and gave my hands a vigorous scrub, feeling like they needed it. I left the restroom and returned to the table in haste, just as the dance music came to a blasting finale. There was tumultuous applause from the dance floor, complete with piercing whistles and foot stompings. I slid onto my chair, snagged my bag from Berlin's chair, and slipped hers into place. Berlin was approaching, the big guy right in her wake. Her chair tilted perilously. I grabbed for it, but not quickly enough to prevent her bag and leather jacket from tumbling on the floor in a heap.
End of Disc 7. Disc 8.
Chapter 19. I'd caught a glimpse of Berlin's mouth, which opened with annoyance when she realized the chair had toppled over. She was looking sweaty and cross, her perpetual state, I suspected. I turned my back abruptly so I was facing the bar. I drank my beer, heart thumping. I heard her exclamation of surprise. "Look at this! God!" She dragged the profanity out into 3 musical notes as she scooped up her belongings, apparently pausing to check the contents of her purse. "Somebody's been in here."
"In your bag?" the guy said.
"Yes, Gary, in my bag," she said, voice heavy with sarcasm.
"Anything missing?"
He seemed concerned, but not freaked out. Maybe he was used to her tone of voice. She said,
"Hey."
I could tell she was speaking in my direction. She poked me in the shoulder.
"I'm talking to you."
I turned, feigning innocence.
"Excuse me?"
"Oh, my God. What the hell are you doing here?" "Well, hi, Berlin. I thought it might be you," I said. "I saw Trini a minute ago, and she said you were around someplace. What's the problem?" She gave the bag a shake as if it were a naughty pup.
"Don't give me that bullshit. Have you been in here?"
I put a hand on my chest and looked around with puzzlement. "I've been in the ladies' room. I just sat down," I said.
"Ha, ha, very funny."
I looked up at the guy with her. "Is she on drugs?" He rolled his eyes.
"Come on now, Burl, settle down, okay? She wasn't bothering you. Give the chick a break. Shut up."
Her blonde hair looked nearly white in the flickering light from above. Her eyes were darkly lined, mascara separating her lashes into tiny rows of spikes. She fixed me with a look of singular intensity,
swelling the way a cat does when it senses a threat. I let my gaze roam across her face, resting on the diamond hoop earrings, which fairly quivered at her ears. I kept my smile pleasant.
"Do you have something to hide, perchance?"
She leaned forward aggressively, and for a moment I thought she might snatch me up by the front of my turtleneck. She put her face so close to mine that I could smell her beery breath, which was not that big a treat.
"What did you say?"
I spoke clearly, enunciating.
"I said, your earrings are nice. I wonder where you got them."
Her face went blank.
"I don't have to talk to you."
I shot a look at the guy just to see how he was taking this. He didn't seem all that interested. Already, I found I liked him better than her.
"How about this? You want to tell me how you acquired so much money in your savings accounts?"
The beefy guy looked from me to her and back, apparently confused.
"You talking to me or her?"
"Actually, to her. I'm a private investigator working on a job," I said. "I don't think you want to get in the middle of this, Gary. Right now we're fine, but it's going to get ugly in a minute." He held up his hands.
"Hey, you two have a beef. You can settle it without me. See you around, Burl. I'm out of here."
I said, "Bye-bye," to him, and then to Berlin. "My car's outside. You want to talk?" We sat in my car. The parking lot outside Neptune's palace seemed to have as much going on as the interior. Two beat cops were having a solemn chat with a kid who seemed to have trouble standing upright. In the aisle ahead of us, and two cars over, a young girl was clinging to someone's fender while she emptied the contents of her stomach. The temperature was dropping, and the sky above us seemed clear as glass. Berlin wasn't looking at me.
"You want to start with the earrings?"
"No."
Sullen, uncooperative.
"You want to start with the money you stole from Lorna?"
"You don't have to take that attitude," she said. "I didn't exactly steal."
"I'm listening."
She seemed to squirm, considering how much to share with me.
"I'm telling you this in strictest confidence, okay?" she said.
I held a hand up, scout style. I love confidences, and the stricter the better. I'd probably rat her out, but she didn't have to know that. She weaseled around some more, mouth working while she decided how to put it.
"Lorna called and told Mom she was going out of town. Mom didn't mention it to me till later, right before she went to work. I was upset because I had to talk to Lorna about this cruise to Mazatlan. She said she might be able to help me out, so I went over there. Her car was there, but her lights were out, and she didn't answer my knock. I figured she was out somewhere. I went back first thing in the morning, hoping I could catch her before she left."
"What time was this?"
"Maybe 9, 9:30.
I was supposed to take the money to the travel agent by noon, or I'd lose my deposit. I'd already given them $1,000, and I had to have the balance or I'd forfeit everything I'd paid."
"That was for the cruise you took last fall?"
"Uh-huh."
"What made you think